thank you very much to all the panelists. I would like to give each of the panelists a couple of minutes to respond to each other. This is a debate. So, in the meantime, I would encourage the audience to write down your questions so we can get your input as well. If you need a card, please raise your hand. If you have a card, please hold up your card so that the runners can actually get them. Thank you. John?
Sure. Well, thanks. And thanks for the presentation, Matthew. I appreciate the give and take. I mean, I guess a couple of things I would say. I said very clearly that the provisions that apply to Parchin are not a precedent. There are specific provisions that would apply moving forward. The specific provisions that are negotiated between the IEA and Iran for Parchin are explicitly only for that facility to resolve the PMD. So
you think that's going to work in practice, though, that Iran's not going to then say, well, we have this agreement.
I interrupt you.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know it was important.
It went back and forth. Okay. I can do that, too. It's written in the agreement that there are provisions that apply moving forward, and there's a roadmap that's negotiated and agreed to that says what's dealing with the past deals with the past. Now, we already know what they did in the past. We're the ones that provided information to the IEA. We declassified our national intelligence estimate from 2003 that laid out their program, and we're the ones that provided the information the IEA laid out in November 2011. So it's very cute to talk about baselining, but we already know what the baseline is. The question is, are we going to force Iran to have a mea culpa and say, yes, we will try to build a nuclear weapon, which they're never going to do, and quite frankly, we don't need them to do. So we can get the satisfaction of them admitting it and having then an active nuclear program, or we can find a way to resolve the PMD that is not a precedent for how we're going to inspect moving forward. You may not believe that, but that's what's in the agreement and what's been negotiated. You said that the detonators and warheads aren't covered in the agreement. In fact, there's a whole list of weaponization activities that are explicitly banned, that Iran may not have any of those activities, which they're alleged to have done prior to 2003, which have dual-use applications, so detonators and neutron initiators that are explicitly prohibited. Even if they have a good reason for it, they're not allowed to do it. So it's in the agreement. I'd encourage you to also read it. You say that Iran has always been 100% accurate. I give you two examples. Supreme Leader said before the negotiations were concluded, we will not settle for less than 100,000 centrifuges. They settled for 5,060 in Natanz and 1,000 in Fordo that can't touch uranium. Iran, under the previous interim agreement, the JPOA, tried to interpret the agreement to allow them to introduce uranium into an advanced centrifuge. It was detected by the IAEA within hours. We confronted them on it, and they had to pull back and admit that they were wrong and misinterpreted. So if your premise is they're always right, we're always wrong, which is not really the position I would take as an administration official, then there's a piece of evidence that suggests your case doesn't hold water. PMD has to be resolved by implementation day. Iran has already provided some information to the IEA. They have to provide answers to the IEA by October 15th. That's in the agreement. And the IEA has to produce its final report on the matter by December 15th. Those things have to happen, along with Iran ripping out all of their extra centrifuges, getting rid of all their extra uranium, shuttering all their other facilities before any sanctions relief goes in. So they don't get anything until they do everything. Now, do they have to then abide by that for 10 or 15 or 20, 25 years? You bet. Do we have a big hammer? You bet. Are we going to be able to use it for everything? Of course not. And we have a full set of provisions that we have worked out with our allies for how we would respond to incremental violations that we know the Iranians are going to try to achieve. Senator said, well, why don't you publish that list? It'll show the Iranians that you mean business. And we said, no, it'll allow the Iranians to calibrate how much do they want to cheat and is it worth this little price. But we and our allies have agreed that if Iran has an incremental violation, which we expect they will try, we will use these incremental sanctions. And if they then say, well, you've imposed sanctions, we're pulling out of the agreement, then we can go and reimpose the full sanctions. This is a give and take. It is an international negotiation. It is imperfect, and it is not, by any means, a guaranteed locked deal no matter what. It's something we're going to have to watch very closely over multiple administrations. But compared to what? The alternative that we've heard is either get a better deal, there isn't one. Our allies have said we're not going back to negotiating tables. The sanctions will unravel. Even if they don't unravel a lot, even if they unravel a little, how do you get a better deal out of the Iranians with less sanctions? How do you get more with less? So that's just not a viable term. And the president did say, yes, the choice between this is this agreement or the inevitability of war. He doesn't say that people want war, although there are some who do. He doesn't say that we're going to do easily in that war, although there are senators who say, like Senator Cotton, oh, a couple of weeks. We've heard this before, right? What he said is that if we don't have this agreement, the sanctions will unravel, the nuclear program in Iran will ramp back up, and there will be people calling to do something about it. The same people that were pushing for military action in Iran in 2011 and 2012, when this country was very close to being pulled into military action against Iran. And the president who ran on a campaign of ending the war in Iraq and ending the war in Afghanistan, and who said we are not going to be blindly sucked into another war without expending all of the diplomatic options available to us, has stuck to his word. If Iran breaks this deal, we will have military options. In fact, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs and the head of intelligence have said, if Iran violates this deal, we will have better military options than we have today. Because normally arms control agreements are we constrain ourselves and they constrain themselves. What this agreement says is Iran constrains themselves and the Department of Defense can continue its buildup, can continue to develop military options to deal with an Iranian nuclear program should they ever try to go for a bomb again. And the president at American University said very clearly, while Iran is allowed to have a peaceful nuclear program if they comply with this agreement, they are never allowed to pursue a weapon under the cover of a peaceful program. And that's been the policy of the United States under multiple presidents, and one that I think will be the policy under future presidents.
Well, there's a lot there to unpack. Again, the IAEA has a list of 12 items on possible military dimensions. They've stonewalled on 11. This isn't about getting Iran to, like, go, ha-ha, and paint them in the corner, and then say, like, see, you were trying to make nuclear weapons. You admitted it. Ha! It's not about that. It is about us knowing how far they've come. That's the important part. And it's literally just flipping the administration's script from saying dozens of times that it's that important and that it has to be done and taken care of, to now then justify it and say, oh, we were just kidding about that. I mean, that just doesn't add up. Now, on what is the alternative, it's a bit frustrating that the administration in their hard sell isn't even doing the unilateral things to strengthen the deal that he could be doing. He could, I'm sure he says that there's a list of penalties that we worked out with Europe. I haven't seen it, and he gives a rationale for it that's well and fine, but deterrence work because someone believes that there is a penalty attached to it. Like, for instance, does anyone believe that Iran thinks when Obama says all options are on the table that moves them, scares them, that they think that the United States is going to do anything, having already passed his own red line with serious chemical weapons before? It's just not something that does anything. So if we have a list of incremental penalties, we need to know that. Iran needs to know that. But specifically, shouldn't our Congress know that? I mean, that's who we elect to represent us. They should know that, and they don't know that. We could be working with our Middle East allies to really push back against Iran, but we're not, and we won't. That's a problem, but that would actually show Iran that we're going to do something. Instead, we're basically propping up his puppet, Assad, in Syria, along with Russia, and we're acting as Iran's air force in Iraq in fighting with ISIS. Our plan is not independent of them. We could affirm as a matter of U.S. policy that the U.S. will use all means necessary to prevent Iran's accumulation of highly enriched uranium, whose only purpose is for a nuclear weapon. And have that endorsed by Congress. Now, that, like I said, all options are on the table doesn't mean anything to anyone. So having that at least spelled out and Congress behind, of course you would have to work with Congress, but to have that spelled out as a matter of U.S. policy, because remember, he'll be gone, Obama, for the duration of the agreement. So that would need to be done beforehand, and so that Iran is aware of that. I mean, you can ensure that Israel would have the means to defend itself or the means to strike Iran if it needed to with the massive ordnance penetrator. It's a bomb that could actually get into Fordow. Another thing that you hear frequently, and I think this is very problematic, is the idea that this deal is going to make us safer and that we'll be better off in 15 years. And that argument only works on the, it's based on the idea that because we've seen the sites that we've seen, we have intelligence on those sites. It's a very short half-life for that form of intelligence. Now remember, during the agreement, they can build anything else that they want that's clandestine, and they have a different verifications process. But I mean, think about this idea though, logically. And during this time, they'll be able to expand their nuclear program after the agreements, because obviously, the breakout time will have dropped down to zero, as the president said himself. They'll have received billions and billions of dollars with which they'll be purchasing tons of weapons, unrestricted air defenses from Russia and from China, but they'll have much better air defenses. They'll modernize their army. Okay, their ICBM, Intercontinental Ballistic Missiles Program, completely left untouched. So now the president, who is now supposedly in a much better position in 15 years, has to think to themselves, if I'm going to use military, a military option, is there going to be an ICBM tipped with a nuclear warhead that can reach Washington or anywhere else in the country? I mean, that's not a better place to be. It's only based on a narrow amount of intelligence. And when you rationally think through where they're going to be in 15 years and where we're going to be, they're going to be in the halls of power, a respected member of the Axis that is now, you know, they bucked the United States, and they're going to be in a much, much, much better position. Our toolkit for what we can do to respond is going to be dramatically curtailed.
So if I can, I know I'm going to get to questions. So just, can you briefly tell me what's the alternative? What's the effective alternative that does those things you want to get done?
The effective alternative was, first of all...
No, moving forward.
Moving forward? Okay, but
I know you have to understand
that when you make the original sin, because this is what the president does, people didn't need to read the agreement. They already knew it was bad. Yeah, people like me already knew the deal was bad in 2013 once we committed the original sin, and that was allowing them the full nuclear cycle to be done on their own soil. That at that moment, where we were granting them something.
So that's a Bush administration official, that's a Bush administration policy. When they put forward their proposal in 2002, they said that Iran can have uranium enrichment once they come back into full compliance. So if you agree original sin, then it's a Bush administration sin, not an Obama administration.
If what you say is 100% accurate, sure. I mean, that's to me, the issue is we're talking about Iran, not Canada. Okay, so
but
Iran having that
but help
is,
the audience
is
and help me understand.
Okay.
What do we do now? If so, Congress endorsed this deal today, right? They did not.
Right.
They did not support the attempt to strip the president's waiver authority to implement this deal. So the deal is
so
going forward.
At a minimum, couldn't we do what I just suggested? The passing of a resolution that says there will be military force, spelling out what the penalties are going to be. Just unilateral things we can do. I mean, say from my perspective, obviously it's like, oh, this is horrible. I have to be part of this agreement. So these are the things that we could do it's the bare minimum without having to go back and renegotiate the entire deal. I mean, again, if we did even one of these things, it would go a long way toward telling the rest of the 79%, according to Pew, you know.
So the deal's okay as long as
we're going to try to do something
that says a future president should use force?
No, look, this deal is not going to be okay.
So
it's
then why
taking a really bad car that doesn't work and trying to slap tires on it? Now you're asking me, since the administration brought, you know, I ordered this car, they said they were going to give me this car, I come to the dealership and they've given me this broken down rusty thing of bolts.
I like the car analogy, I use it all the time, but my question is, I mistakenly vote for you for President of the United States, and you're in charge now. Is there something, so, because the alternative before, it's a policy debate, right? I can go on TV all I want and make lots of cute points, but we have to deal with the world as it is. Iran wasn't going to give up all of their nuclear program.
Okay.
So they're going to be left, even if you got rid of all the facilities, you can't...
We didn't use all of the leverage at our disposal. Remember, this president fought every part of the sanctions that we put against Iran. He likes to say, because of those tough sanctions that came to the table, he was against those sanctions.
George Bush is a very tough president. Under George Bush, we invaded Iraq. Right, we threatened to go after Iran and North Korea, and Iran went from having zero centrifuges to 5,000 centrifuges.
All right, Can I...
You want to debate?
Yes. It's true. Very good.
We didn't try here to agree with each other.
I just want to make sure we get a little bit of time for questions from the audience. We can have the last 20 minutes for three questions, depending on how far we go. Thank you both for very interesting statements.
This question is addressed to whomever wants to answer it. What's the difference between the Iran agreement and a treaty?
A treaty, if it were submitted to the Congress and ratified by the President, if approved, would have the force of law and would extend beyond the term of any individual president. An executive agreement, which this is a political agreement, and the next president will have within his rights the political empowerment to alter its terms if he so chooses.
I would also like to add to that, though, that if it looks like a duck and walks like a duck, it's a duck. If you've ever seen anything that's a treaty, this is what looks like a treaty. And the functional difference as far as legally would require two-thirds of Congress or the Senate to say that we approve of this treaty. And making it an executive agreement, it requires two-thirds of Congress. It's basically flipped on the side, on its head. Two-thirds have to be opposed to it, as opposed to four. So it's
60.
Right. So it's basically flipping it on its head. The onus would be on the president to say with a treaty that this is good and the country will support it and will be for it, as opposed to what it is right now. It's a different threshold.
But so I think there's a reasonable legal debate about.
Let me follow up with that. Can a new president, in your views, you're the experts, if the new president rejects this deal, what do you think Iran's reaction to that is going to be?
So if Democrat or Republican says, I want a tougher deal, I want better terms, they can go back to negotiating whatever time they want. Iran can say, oh, you're right, I'll give up more. What they probably will do is rescind the waiver and reimpose sanctions, at which point Iran will be within its rights under this agreement to restart all of its nuclear activities, and they can try to go back to the negotiating table. But I think the result will be Iran to rapidly expand its nuclear capability and significantly try to increase their leverage over us and shorten their breakup time.
If I could just add quickly that this deal for Iran is so absolutely good, so wonderful if they comply, that even if we were to do a vote against the deal, and that were to occur right now, it would be 6 to 9 months before they fulfill their agreements and sanctions would come off. We still wouldn't be in violation of the agreement, which is now an international agreement at the UN. Iran, it would behoove them, if they're a rational actor, to stick to the terms of the deal and try to have the United States be the isolated group. Because if they stick to this agreement, it's wonderful for them. So it doesn't mean that if the deal is scrapped or something that they're immediately going to rush toward a breakout. That would be them really destroying 20 years of work on a nuclear program. It wouldn't make rational sense.
Of course, the Iranians have said, and since you believe the Iranians are always right.
I know.
But if the United States,
I believe they're right on the way they interpret parts of the agreement.
If the deal, Iran will not implement their part of the deal, which means they'll keep 19,000 centrifuges. They'll pursue their advanced R&D. And they'll keep all the uranium, which gives them a breakout time in 2 or 3 months. So at a minimum, they stay there. Maybe they accelerate, maybe they don't. But the status quo, according to Prime Minister Netanyahu, is unacceptable.
Right. It's unfortunate we didn't work towards something better during this time. I agree.
If I may, briefly, the question on the treaty, just from an international law point of view, it is a treaty. But from a U.S. point of view, it's an executive.
None of our
that parties, should make you scratch your head a little.
None of our parties use the word treaty in discussing this agreement.
Right, because
right.
For political reasons.
Yeah. Let's be honest. This is a treaty. It
I'm sorry,
deals
I
with arms.
I operate under our Constitution.
Right.
The President determines whether or not... So status of forces agreements would put U.S. forces under legal constrictions are not submitted as treaties. It is the President's discretion.
21% in favor of this, that he's done this without Congress and without the American people. If it were a treaty, as you would suggest, this wouldn't be occurring. It's remarkable time.
Once the sanctions... I'm not sure that question was answered. Once, once the sanctions are lifted and there's significant foreign investment in and trade with Iran, what is the realistic likelihood that sanctions could be reimposed and be complied with by other nations? And how long would it really realistically take to put those sanctions back into place?
This is a great question. We got it a lot during the process and in the discussion with members of Congress. These sanctions are UN-backed, and what they essentially do is cut Iran off from the international banking system. So let's take an example where a Dutch company wants to build a desalinization plant in Iran. And the deal goes into force, the sanctions are lifted, they sign the deal, and a year later Iran violates. And we snap back the sanctions. There will be a limited amount of time, roughly 30 to 60 days, depends on the nature of the relationship, for that company to unwind its business affairs. And at that point, the United States will determine that it will enforce those sanctions, both by preventing any financial transfers from Iran to the Dutch entity and back, but also, if the Dutch company doesn't comply, cutting off the Dutch company from the U.S. banking system.
I think the sense of that question was, how long would it take for the weight of this to have any real effect?
See, there's the key part. That's the key part. Because remember, the sanctions, which on one hand Obama says aren't going to work and they don't work and they can't change Iran's behavior, but they're the best penalty in the planet, if we're going to need to give them a penalty, we're not going to have enough time to reapply sanctions and to have those sanctions actually work as a penalty. So we're really left with pretty much nothing. So the sanctions, right, it took years and years and years to get it to a point finally that Obama was opposing, that they were beginning to take a bite on Iran's economy in 2012, 2013. But we don't have years, because we already know that where their breakout time is. So it's a glaring hole.
So actually what we've said is that these are the toughest sanctions that have ever been instituted over a nuclear program. That they are the sanctions that brought Iran to the nuclear table and put them in a position where they're going to give up their ability to build a nuclear weapon and be put under severe constraints in the most intrusive inspection regime ever negotiated with a country. However, we do not believe that if Iran violates an agreement and we reimpose sanctions, that that will convince them like that to change back. We think the deterrent force of imposing sanctions will keep them from cheating in a significant way.
You'll have to excuse me, but I'm a trial lawyer. The question was asked, how long will the weight of the take for the weight of the sanctions to be effective?
Define effective for me, sir.
No, you're the expert.
Well, are you... I'm not a lawyer.
Wait a minute, I'll define it. Okay. To affect Iran's behavior.
I believe that the threat of sanctions is already affecting Iran's behavior. That's why they've agreed to this deal. And I believe that the vast majority of Iranians who desperately want jobs and integration in the international system will be extremely nonplussed, to say the least, if their leaders restart a nuclear program that will never come to fruition and put them back under sanctions.
Now, this is a three-part question. So it sort of goes like this. Putting different questions together in the same question. What's the role of the Revolutionary Guard in Iran? What do you make of the fact that there is a Quds division of the Iranian Guard, and Quds means Jerusalem? And who makes the decision to cheat or comply with the deal? I think the implication is, who does that?
The Ayatollah is the number one guy in charge. To the extent that everyone in the West has been told, President Rouhani is a great reformer president. Who cares? It's Ayatollah Khamenei. He's the guy who makes the decisions. Now, the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guards, is a huge component. They're certainly hardline. It's the revolutionary military aspect of the regime, and they certainly do are hardliners there. And they have their own business interests. Remember, this isn't a democratic state. They have a lot of their own business interests, and we're delisting a lot of those, unfortunately, with our sanctions relief, like I said, including the Quds commander Soleimani, which is absolutely ridiculous. He's a terrorist. It has nothing to do with the nuclear program, as you can see. So they do play a big role. What was the other part of the question that you needed?
Who will make the decision, Richie?
Oh, who would make the decision? You know, it could be the IRGC by themselves, but most likely it would come from Khamenei. I mean, there is a... Khamenei is in charge of the entire country, of that there's no doubt. But the IRGC has had taken a larger leadership type role and has grown a lot more powerful inside of Iran since the revolution in 79. They've played a much bigger role, and that role is increasing.
So I think that's right on the role of the IRGC. Interestingly, they have gone from being the elite military forces to actually having a hand in most of the economic entities. Because of the sanctions, they've had to step into that role. What's interesting is if you want to go after the money source for the IRGC, a way to do that is by lifting sanctions, because who would buy an Iranian-made washing machine when they could buy a Chinese-made one?
Right, and therefore we're lifting him off of Ayatollah, too.
And actually, and Soleimani is delisted under nuclear. He remains listed under terrorism. He remains listed under human rights abuses. So Soleimani is not getting any sanctions relief. He's being dropped from one of seven listings. So there's no impact on Soleimani. He still can't travel. We're not lifting our arms.
It was just in Russia, though.
but it was a violation of sanctions.
So we have one last question.
Can I answer the question, which is on the cheat?
We do.
So who makes this decision to cheat? So fortunately, the IRGC doesn't have much of a role in the declared nuclear facilities. They have had a significant role in protecting the undeclared sites we've discovered. It's actually one of the ways we discover them, is because they're pretty clumsy at it. But the belief is that it would be a combination of the Supreme Leader working with the Atomic Energy Agency of Iran and probably the Quds forces.
If we got 20 questions, fully half of them demonstrate a real skepticism that this inspection regime will work. I mean, this audience is highly skeptical of that. So the question is, assume for the sake of discussion that the inspection regime does not work. Where are we then?
So nuclear inspections are a whole science and policy and art to itself. No inspection regime is ever 100% perfect. What you try to do is develop an inspection and verification regime that is effective, meaning that it can prevent Iran or any party from gaining any significant military advantage before you can detect them. So it's in the time we have left, what I will do is I'll refer you to the editorial written by David Kay. David Kay has 20 years at the International Atomic Energy Agency. He was part of the head of the inspection team in Iraq before the Gulf War, and was appointed by George Bush and Donald Rumsfeld to be in charge of the Iraq survey group in the hunt for WMDs that never turned up. And he wrote a piece that basically lays out the standards that you should seek in terms of an effective verification provision that ran on the nation. He basically comes out and says, this is not a perfect verification regime, but is more than capable of detecting any militarily significant activities by Iran. Mm-hmm. So my point of view is we know Iran's going to try and cheat, but it can't cheat and get any closer to a bomb without us detecting it. And that's a good standard.
I would just say without a good verifications regime, this deal is really worthless. But again, we'll have already given up all the sanctions relief and all of our leverage in the beginning to find that lesson out the hard way. So the bottom line is, for this deal to work, it's based on a lot of hope, and it's not based on our experience.
Okay, let's finish with the student.
Okay. Yeah, this is a student question, not my own.
Not that you're fine.
Just wanted to clear.
If it's really good, I'm going to give you credit.
Okay, sure. When the deal expires and Iran attempts to create a bomb in this hypothetical case, will other Middle Eastern states respond with their own nuclear bomb program?
Yes, I mean, absolutely. It's funny, the administration uses the same argument that the critics use, that with the deal or without the deal, and that's just how both sides are saying it, that the rest of the countries in the Gulf, you know, Saudi Arabia is not going to sit by and say, oh, our grand Shia enemy has nuclear weapons and we're just going to sit here and do nothing. Of course they're going to get their own. Egypt, not to be undone by, you know, the other powerful Sunni state, is going to do the same thing. And we'll have a cascade of nuclear proliferation throughout the entire region, and honestly, this is a fantastic region, I'm sure, to have a nuclear arms race. It's like Armageddon.
So, two things on the end and a point of agreement. This deal does not expire. Despite your protests, there is no sunset. There are provisions that do phase out after some number of years, but there's some provisions that last in perpetuity. So there is no sunset clause. However, if at some point Iran acquires a nuclear weapon, we do believe that put a tremendous amount of pressure on states to follow suit, which is why we think it's imperative that we not allow Iran to acquire a nuclear weapon, which this agreement does, and which, if they violate, we're in a much better position to prevent them from acquiring that capability.
But they're not waiting, incidentally. The Gulf countries and Egypt, they're not waiting for Iran to have a nuclear missile on the pad with steam coming out of it like you see in the movies, and they're just waiting to launch, and then they're going to say, wait, maybe we should get our own. No, they've seen the deal, they know what's in the deal, and this is going to happen right now. That's the bottom line. They're not saying to themselves, I'll wait until the sunset provisions, which are the most important provisions that prevent them from getting a nuclear weapon, that they're going to wait until Iran is that advanced and then start their own program. That's going to happen.
So you can go to the White House website. You can actually see what the individual countries have said. When the Gulf leaders came to Camp David, most of them made statements in support of the agreement. They believe that we are in a better position to challenge Iran in the region with this agreement and without Iran having a weapon. But we do agree that it would be very concerning if Iran was able to acquire one because of what those states would do. And one of the reasons we work already very closely with them to enhance their interdiction capability, their military capability while preserving Israel's qualitative military advantage, why we're encouraging them to work with us on missile defense, on counterinsurgency, and why we're going to continue pushing them to do more and to improve their capabilities to confront Iran.
If you believe, incidentally, that the Sunni countries are behind this deal, despite what they say, I have bridges I'd love to sell you.
All right. I have the last word. I would like to encourage you to fill out our survey. I would like to thank all of you who come out. Let's thank our panelists.
The last question is whether anybody mentioned anybody else.
Right.
So I didn't start with him.
Yep. I don't know.
I'm not
joining up.
Good night and good luck.